Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Hello there and welcome to the program. We begin in Niu. Niu's public broadcaster hopes to have a groundbreaking digital service on air by early next year. The news service has been in the wind for the past year, and the general manager, Trevor Tiakia, told Don Wiseman that BCN is still preparing to make 12 channels available.
At the moment, we're in the testing phase for the channels that we have been able to acquire rights from.
So you've got quite a number from New Zealand, I think, haven't you?
Yes.
What about sports channels, news channels?
We have also acquired rights for the news channels and also a sports channel. But we have an agreement with BBCL, which was appointed by the New Zealand government to handle all the Pacifica TV. There will be sports coming through that channel in our normal TV news channel.
Now, what it means is everyone's got to switch to digital, don't they? Because you're shutting down analog.
Eventually, we're heading towards that way.
So people are getting little receivers put on their houses at the moment.
Customers will have a UHF antenna and also a set-top box with a card in their homes.
What are the costs to the typical resident?
The cost for the normal TV Nui channel still remains, because that's the annual subscription fee that covers the TV Nui channel. But anything outside of that, the customer pays for the extra channels.
The TV Niue fee is what we might have called in the old days a license fee. How much is that annually?
The license fee is charged at $75 every 3 months.
Okay, and in terms of the charges for channels?
In terms of charges for channels, for example, if you want the news package, that's an additional $15 on top. Entertainment package, that's an extra that the customer needs to pay also.
So that's every 3 months?
That's every 3 months.
You expect everything to be up and running when?
Hopefully when we iron out some fading problems that we have with the outer villages, we'll be able to launch sometimes in the new year.
In Olofi, in the main town of Olofi, what's the quality of reception like there?
From Avasele right through to Tui, the signal quality is excellent. But for the remaining villages on the other side, we have a fading signal problem.
Okay, so what's the solution there?
We need to install another couple of antennas on top of our tower that feeds the northern side and increase the power of the transmitter and also for the southern side.
Okay, you're getting, I know, quite a lot of aid support for this, but it's a very big project for Broadcast Niue, isn't it?
Yes, it's big, but we are excited.
That was Trevor Tiakia speaking to Don Wiseman. He's the general manager of the public broadcaster in Niue, saying that they're preparing to make 12 digital channels available. Now, this past year has been an interesting one when it comes to news. If anyone has been following, or was following, I should say, the elections in the United States, you'll know that very often news was distorted. It was very much a he said, she said kind of thing, with all kinds of conspiracy thoughts coming up. Now, many of these conspiracies were actually propagated by the internet, which seems to be a breeding ground for conspiracies, especially on social media sites like Twitter and Facebook. Now, what has actually happened is that very often some of these conspiracy stories come from websites that are supposed to look like the real news sites of real organizations. For example, ABC News. Now, I don't mean the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, but I mean the American Broadcasting Company had a website called abcgo.com. But there was one that was set up called abcgo.com. Something else that actually is supposed to look like the real ABC News website, but it isn't. On social media, for example, on Facebook, the fake web links actually look real. Over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of discussion about Facebook and them going to go after fake news websites and fake stories. But the problem is, can they really do this? And will it really happen? Because it's becoming more and more common for people to get their daily news from websites like Facebook. But how is journalism prioritized in people's feeds, and what is being hidden? Matthew Ingram is a senior writer at Fortune magazine in Toronto, Canada. He speaks next to Richard Ady.
It far outweighs, I think, any previous form of media that I can think of. So even the largest, you know, TV network or newspaper or radio broadcaster, Facebook reaches over a billion people. Whether it's, you know, a key component of the way they find news is up for debate. But most research shows that for, you know, a substantial double-digit percentage of those people, Facebook is either the leading way or one of the leading ways that they find news.
We should just reiterate how they find news, because essentially what happens is if you're on Facebook and you're interested in something, Facebook notices what you're interested in and uses that information to populate your news feed.
Right. So they look at a whole bewildering spectrum of behavior. And in fact, some of the things they look at, obviously, we don't really know because they don't open up about how the news feed is structured. But they look at things you click on, obviously, things you like, things you share, things you comment on. But they look at other things as well. How quickly you scroll past something in your feed is something they look at. And they take all of those inputs and then try and come up with things to show you.
Right. So this is the Facebook algorithm. And we do not know what is in the algorithm, but we do know that they're tweaking it a lot.
Right. In fact, one estimate I've seen is that they tweak it every week, if not more. Some small, obviously, some large, some they talk about, some they don't talk about.
Now, there's been a few things that have happened, Matthew. One is that everybody is trying to, tweak their content in a way that they think the Facebook algorithm will like and reward them for.
Right. One way that news sites do this is by trying to come up with a headline or a lead or a photo or all of those things put together that will make something stand out in the feed or will appeal to the algorithm, which of course they're trying to sort of reverse engineer. But you also see some more odd things. For example, Jay Rosen, who's a journalism professor in New York, was one of the people trying to hack the Facebook algorithm he posts links to blog posts he's written, but he makes it sound as though the update is about something personal. So he will say, hey, my Facebook friends, great news about something in my personal life. And then he'll have a link to just a regular blog post about journalism because he's trying to trick Facebook into showing everyone his update.
So there's also been the rise, at least temporarily, of sites like Upworthy, which have seemed almost completely dependent on being able to game that Facebook algorithm.
Right. Upworthy, there's another one called Viral Nova. There's one that's, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's specifically conservative or sort of extreme right-wing politically and uses the same techniques, clickbait, as some people call it. BuzzFeed is also quite heavily reliant on Facebook. And so everyone tries to track measurements of whose stuff is getting shared the most. For example, a company called NewsWhip from Europe tracks those sorts of things, and everyone's looking to see, you know, who went up, who went down. Upworthy was penalized to some extent by a recent Facebook change. So everyone was trying to figure out, well, does Upworthy do that we shouldn't do? And of course, Facebook is of no help in kind of trying to figure that out.
This is not healthy, is it, in a way? If everyone is worried about using Facebook as essentially their broadcast or publication method, that's not good.
It's definitely not it's not what you would want. It's certainly not what I would want, to have a single entity having that much influence over what people see. And it's quite staggering. Some sites that aren't even sort of on the upward end of the spectrum, sites like The Atlantic, for example, are seeing over 50% of their traffic come from social networks, and the majority of that is Facebook, or at least a gigantic proportion. So you have to, as a news site, as a media entity, you effectively have to play Facebook's game, but you don't know what that game is. You don't know how the rules are changing. It's as though you're playing a game of football and someone is changing the rules, but they're not telling you what the rules are. And so you have to try to reverse engineer what the rules are by watching what happens to people. So everyone is trying to figure out, well, Facebook just says the same thing that Google said, which is just create really great content, which is of no help whatsoever because everyone thinks that's what they're doing. But some of it reaches lots of people and some doesn't. You can't really know what Facebook considers great content. And then there's the related problem, which is that Facebook is a proprietary entity. It's a publicly traded company with shareholders and investors, and it's not in the business of journalism or media or even social policy or sort of, it has no ethical principles except the ones that its CEO imposes. It's a corporation. And so to have a single corporate entity with that kind of power is kind of disturbing.
Do we know how influential that news feed that Facebook provides is?
Well, we can certainly see it happen when these tables come out that NewsWhip and other companies, where they look at the kind of traffic that sites are getting from Facebook. We're talking about potentially millions of page views or millions of unique visitors. Economically speaking, that's a game changer for a website. It could make the difference between success or failure.
There was that story not that long ago from Mother Jones saying Facebook tweaked the news feeds of almost 2 million people, I think it was, in 2012, and that this ultimately affected voter turnout rates at the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's and extraordinary in a way, isn't it?
It is. It definitely is. And this is the second time that we've seen research confirming that in fact happened, that they tweaked the news feed and voter behavior basically was changed. Obviously, Facebook is saying, well, you know, we're just experimenting and this is just an interesting kind of sociological outcome. But it is disturbing to the extent that Facebook isn't saying what the criteria were. And at least the implication is they could influence an election or part of an election, pro or con. You know, obviously they wouldn't probably try and rig an election for a specific person, but even for them to have that impact is fascinating. Obviously, newspapers used to have impact as well.
Yeah.
The New York Times, Washington Post, you know, they would pick a candidate. But we're talking about an entity that reaches hundreds of millions of voters. It's like every newspaper and every radio station and every TV channel rolled into one.
Of course, it's not saying the same thing to all of them. This is critical. It tailors the news feed. It tailors what it does. And in this example, what happened was, in the months leading up to the election, Facebook added more hard news items in news feeds to about, I think, 1.9 million people. And as a result, they found a statistically significant increase in the amount of attention paid to what you might call news about government or politics. And then the number of people who at least claimed they'd voted went from 64% to 67%. Now, that is a difference.
It is. And 3 percentage points is, you know, that's more than just statistically significant. That's a substantial increase. Now, obviously, there's a number of things you would have to assume. You'd have to assume that all those people who said they voted did vote. Then you'd have to assume that was actually what caused this increase in voter turnout. But it's fascinating, but also disturbing, because we don't know what else Facebook is doing with the news feed. This is one example from 2012 where they tracked it and a couple of outside researchers wrote about it. We just don't know what else they're doing and what impact it's going to have. We saw when the riots and so on were happening in Ferguson after the shooting of a young black man, Facebook, relatively speaking, at least compared to Twitter, had very little about that incident. It had far more about the ice bucket challenges that people were doing, and that has a real impact, or could have a real impact, on the way people perceive certain events or perceive social or political issues.
Mm. Matthew, it seems to me that something has changed in the last year, because it's only really a year ago that the Pew Research Center put out a report that found that the role of news on Facebook's common but incidental. So it's sort of there a lot, but it doesn't mean much. That was the more or less the takeaway. A year on, people feel differently, don't they?
I think they're starting to. I mean, one of the hard things about sort of trying to grapple with this is there has been research like the Pew report that showed people don't go to Facebook for news. They sort of encounter it while they're doing other things. And yet it still can have this fairly dramatic impact, which is kind of amazing. Just imagine if people did start going to Facebook for news, or if Facebook made a more concerted effort to become a news entity, which I think in a way it is trying to do. It's having a noticeable impact by accident, which is kind of frightening.
You've already mentioned Twitter, and of course, and we've been talking about this algorithm is king approach taken by Facebook. But there is now, I understand, some concern that Twitter might also do something along these lines.
Depending on who you talk to, it's a sort of fear, or it is coming. We've heard from a number of senior executives that Twitter is experimenting with adding things to your timeline. And we know that it's doing this because we can see favorites that other people post showing up, people we don't even follow.
Mm.
We can start to see specific tweets showing up that are being basically shown to us even though we don't actively follow that person. That's additional material. Crucial difference between Twitter and Facebook is Facebook hides certain things. It doesn't just show you new things. Twitter, at least to this point, is only showing you new things. It isn't removing certain things so you don't see them.
Let's talk about a few of the other problems with Facebook, because you've essentially said you can't not play with them. It would be mad not to. You're denying yourself some audience. But there's surely ways of doing it and ways in which the traditional news media could improve that will mean, well, hopefully survival, if not the previously wonderfully high-margin businesses they used to be.
I think that's the real... That's what media, whether they know it or not, is sort of wrestling with now. I mean, Facebook is so huge. It now serves the same function that newsstands and newspaper boxes and satellites and satellite networks used to fulfill for traditional media. It is the way people find information. So you can't just not be there because you would be cutting yourself off from a huge proportion of the population. But every time you give your content to Facebook and people find it that way, they come to see Facebook as the place where they got that news, not you. So you have to do it. So then how do you do it so that Facebook doesn't get all of the value, that you still have some? And the only thing I can come up with is there are certain things that Facebook can't do. So it can give people a headline and a photo and maybe a few paragraphs and a link. It can allow people to comment and like or share, and that's good. But I think you have to think as a media outlet about the things you can provide to your readers that Facebook can't. So access to the people who actually wrote that thing, you can do that. Facebook can also do that if your writers have Facebook pages, but you can provide more access. So you can give readers the ability to interact with that writer about that topic in far deeper or richer ways than Facebook could. You could even give them the ability to meet them in person or at a physical event. I think you have to think about what, assuming that they come into contact with your content through Facebook, what can you do after that to sort of take advantage of this new relationship with that person?
Yeah, adding value in a way that essentially traditional media hasn't had to think about at all. But it's a bigger problem in a way, Matthew. You've pointed out that the competition is not just as it was in the old days of the media providers. And it's not even just Facebook, as big as that is. It's anything that competes for a reader's or listener's time and engagement. And there's now so much more stuff that does.
Right. That's something, you know, that I had sort of thought about in a vague sort of way. And a developer who does a lot of work with media companies named Stein De Bruyere, I think is his last name, wrote a whole blog post about how this is something that traditional media entities have not grappled with, even if they kind of feel it. If someone wanted, you know, entertainment news or a review of a movie, or they're thinking about going to a movie, they might go to your entertainment section in the past. Now they might avoid your entertainment section altogether because they can find reviews of that movie anywhere. They can find friends on Facebook who've seen it. They can go to Yelp. They can go to dozens of recommendation services. You've been removed from that equation effectively, or a chunk of your newspaper has. And if you go through the sort of sections or parts of a traditional media entity, you can see that happening in almost every case, whether it's comics, the classifieds, the real estate section, the auto section, all the things that used to be built up around the news and helped pay for it. Your competition for those things is everywhere. It's in many cases free, and in many cases it's also better than what you were used to providing. So in some cases, it's not only difficult to compete, it may be impossible to compete with that thing that is now taking away the attention of your readers in that area. And all those things are the things that you used to monetize the stuff no one will pay for, the hard news or the investigative news or the sort of long feature stories.
Yes. So what can we do? Because there has to be, I know that is probably the $64 billion question. But I mean, there must be things that people are trying.
I guess the sort of lesson that I was trying to get across about Facebook goes for all sorts of things. To me, it starts with the relationship that you, whether you're a writer or an individual journalist or a media entity, have with your audience, your readers, your community. And that is the only thing you have that is of any value anymore. You may have thought your printing presses had value. They don't. You may have thought your fancy building downtown had value. It doesn't. To me, the only thing that you can build on is that relationship that you have with your readers and your audience. So then how do you do that? You have to think about all the things you can give them that they can't get somewhere else. So if they're getting the news, the headlines, the lead of your story, if they're getting a brief, you know, aggregated version of your scoop, if they're getting all of those things that you used to provide, what is left? What is the thing that you do that no one else does? And the problem, I guess, is for some media companies, they may not have an answer to that question. They don't do anything particularly unique, in which case their future does not look bright.
Matthew Ingram, a senior writer at Fortune magazine in Toronto, Canada, talking about people getting their news from Facebook and how it is often and can be distorting. He was speaking there with Richard Ady. Coming up in a moment, Glenn Hauser will be joining us for this week's Propagation. We'll be right back.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, which is speeded to 22 journals.
Speed 220, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right, now time for Propagation. Here's our Propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through December 3rd, normal at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through December 3rd, magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through December 4th, solar activity, just occasional common class flares, a slight 20% chance of moderate class flare activity. Geomagnetic activity mainly quiet to unsettled. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on December 3rd to 6th and 14th to 16th. Quiet to active on December 7th, 9th, 10th to 12th, 19th and 21st. Active to disturbed on December 8th and 20th. Mostly quiet on December 13th, 17th and 18th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active levels expected from December 7th to 11th and 19th to 24th, with G1 minor geomagnetic storm levels likely on December 10th, with ANK indices of 20 and 5, and December 21st and 22nd, peaking at 30 and 5. solar fluctuating between 82 and 78 through Christmas Eve. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, microwave DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting, December 4th to 6th, off the west coast of Africa to Cabo Verde, December 5th and 6th, off the coast of Namibia and South Africa, until December 4th, between Oman and India, December 3rd, along the coast of Queensland, Australia.
All right, thank you very much, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of the program. I just want to remind you right now that we are in the month of December, so we do have a few weeks to go before the end of the year. And the last program of 2016 is going to be our annual bloopers program. Yes, bloopers that were sent in from various listeners from various countries around the world. And that's coming up on the last edition of Media Network Plus for 2016. If you want to get in touch with us, and actually we still haven't recorded the show, so you can still send something in. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.